Well, here it is, the shape we should have. The shape we see in almost every single TV ad, in every magazine we read. This is the shape of the beautiful woman. The shape of the successful woman. Even the shape of the successful mother. This is the shape of the winner. This is Christy Brinkley, by the way, who's the highest paid model in the world and who feels very uncomfortable with her thighs and her hips. She says they're too fat.
Poor thing.
Yeah. The ideal is not too old.
In fact, never old at all. Even if you are as old as Jane Fonda, you don't look old, do you?
Not fat at all. Legs long and lean. Waist thin. Bust ample. It's a very narrow idea. In fact, it's almost a pinpoint ideal in age and body structure and body proportion. And now a new thing, coming on strong, with muscles that are supple, but showing slightly, not too much, but still showing. And you know what? Even though we don't look like the models that we see in the ads, we still think we could if we would just diet with more willpower and do our exercises more vigorously. And so we start every class with high hopes and every diet with high hopes. This time it'll work. This time I'll get my body into the shape it's supposed to be. We're in a continual cycle trying to remake our bodies, and it starts when we're young. This is the new great shape Barbie doll. She's on the cartoons.
Yeah, I watched Saturday morning with my four-year-old daughter, and they show two little girls playing with Barbie, making her do her leg lifts, and then when Barbie walks away, the one little girl says, "Where is she going now?" And the other little girl says, "Oh, with that shape, it must be a date."
And now we have a Christian version of the exercise Barbie doll.
It's called Exercise Genie the Believer, Christian alternative to Barbie. The ad that we saw for Exercise Genie the Believer looks exactly like the Barbie doll, the same body and everything.
We just want you to look at the body proportions on this doll. This doll's been with us for 25 years. Little kids have been playing, little girls have been playing with this. Do you remember the very first time you thought about dieting? Do you remember how old you were when you went on your very first diet? Studies tell us now that for most girls, age 11 and 12, is the time when they're initiated into a lifetime of dieting. That means that already, by the time a girl is that age, she knows there's something wrong with her body and that's got to be fixed.
It's even happening earlier these days. I have a 9-year-old niece. 2 years ago, she came home from school in tears and said, "Mom, my legs are fat." Krista, she's the skinniest, scrawniest little kid you ever saw, and she was worried about her fat thighs. This summer, when we were at a conference where our book was announced, a woman came up to us afterwards and said, "I'm so glad that you're writing a book about this topic. Nobody in my church, I can't think of one person in my church who likes their body." And furthermore, she said, "My daughter is, 7?
Mm-hmm.
Keeps bugging me to diet. She wants to go on a diet." And the mother said, "She's not heavy. She doesn't need to diet, but she wants to start a diet."
We were so shocked to hear that dieting awareness might start at 7 years of age. I mean, because I have a 3-year-old, Annie, and Marge has a 4-year-old, and we're not so sure that at the age of 7, I want my little girl, Annie, to already begin to be unhappy with her body.
I think you need to change the picture here.
Yes, I do need to change the picture.
You know, what's interesting is that this was not always so, this obsession with the thin body. This is a Renaissance painting of Peter Paul Rubens. Wouldn't you have liked to have lived in this day and age? We were just born in the wrong time, weren't we? Even in our own culture, this was the sex symbol of the 50s. There she is, Marilyn Monroe. No movie studio would let her near the screen today. She does not have that body we saw at the opening. There she is again in a, I think that's a picture for Anastasia. Or look at the way the Miss Americas looked 20, 30 years ago.
Marilyn,
well, this is still Marilyn.
Mean,
yeah, I thought you were going to push the button again.
What is the difference between her and 10?
Bo Derek, was it? Mm-hmm. This is the way the Miss Americas looked 20, 30 years ago. That's not the way they look today. It's been recent. The last 20 years it's been that this ultra-thin body is what we're told that we need to have.
The director of the Miss Texas pageant put it this way in a recent Newsweek article. He said, the girls who were winning pageants 10 years ago couldn't make the top 10 now. They're better trained, they're better physically, they're smarter, they're more sophisticated. And the article continued, where buxom 140-pound beauties were once the norm in Atlantic City, this year 35-inch busts abound, and the heaviest contestant weighs in at 125.
And she's 5'10".
Mm-hmm. Well, what is it that these Miss America pageants are saying to us now? Did you know that consistently 75% of the people who receive the Miss America pageant are women? Well, it's pretty simple. It's giving us what the ideally shaped American woman's body should look like. And is this going to keep changing, this ideal shape? Yeah. A few years ago, or 10 years ago, if you were a size 10 or 12, you were considered very thin. Now models wear size 6 or 8. It's a very thin, pencil-thin body. And in order to get models this thin, in many cases, younger models, young girls are being used, younger girls.
Even as young as prepubescent, actually, or pre-adolescent. One of the very high fashion models, highly paid fashion models in our country is Christine Ullman, who is 12 and is dressed up to look older, of course.
This is the waist that we're going to be seeing more and more. This comes from a popular fitness book just released by the man who's the head of the Nautilus weight training equipment. By this picture, which is shocking, he puts, this is the well-toned waistline of a woman in good shape. But see, that's the point of an ideal, and this is a very critical thing for us as women to understand. The ideal is always something that's just out of reach. If everybody could get it, it wouldn't be ideal. But another important point, we're continually told that we can have the ideal. We can have the ideal car, the ideal job, the ideal mate, the ideal children, the ideal house. You can have it all.
If you buy this perfume or this piece of exercise equipment or this yogurt, just think what would happen to our culture. The whole thing, our economy would collapse if we didn't believe that we could keep, get this kind of a particular body. What is needed for maintaining the fitness economy is not 100 million number ones, or actually number tens is what we're talking about here. Because if we were all number tens, then we wouldn't need to buy these products. It has to be kept just out of our reach so that we think we can get it.
Yeah, the sponsors of the Miss America pageant know that. In exchange for sponsoring the pageant, they say they get beautiful women to sell their products. A beautiful woman, and especially the American ideal of Miss America, which is a very wholesome sex symbol, an interesting contradiction there, that sells products, and they know that. So, but we need to make sure we don't put it all on the culture. We do it ourselves.
The fact is that when you go to the bookstore to buy a fitness book or an exercise book, you probably would not buy one if it had a stocky, 55-year-old gray-haired woman on the front. That's not what you're after. You've all heard of the celebrity fitness books. You've heard of Jane Fonda's and Victoria Principles, but you probably have never heard of, or maybe not as many of you have heard of some of the exercise physiologists, such as Dr. Joan Ulliott, or Judy Alter, who are writing books that are telling us, giving us a better view of fitness. Something that's not so ultra perfect.
Mm-hmm. So here we are, and we have this body ideal on one hand, and on the other hand, we have the bodies we actually have. So what do? Well, it's simple. We believe the ideal, and we don't accept the bodies that we had. There was a recent study done in Glamour magazine where they interviewed 33,000 women. Three quarters of them said they were too fat. Three quarters of them said they needed to lose weight. Now, what's interesting is that these women were not overweight. Only a quarter of them were overweight by height-weight charts. But still, three out of four of them said they were too thin. As a matter of fact, almost half of the women who were actually underweight by height-weight charts said they were too fat too, and that they frequently wanted to diet. The point of the study being, and a very critical thing for us as women to understand, is that it makes no difference what your weight is. If you are overweight, normal weight, or underweight, if you are an American woman, you will view yourself as too heavy.
Worse yet, the desire to be thin is complicated by the issue of body proportions. It's not just that you want to be thin, it's that you want to have the right proportions. This study of these 33,000 people went on to ask the women which part of their bodies they liked best and which they liked least. Which part of your body do you like best? Can you guess what one?
Easy, feet. Feet. 81% of the women thought their feet were just fine.
And 75% of them said their calves were okay.
Yeah.
But guess what the other end was? What is it? 85% of them?
Well,
didn't
about
like
60%
their...
were real dissatisfied with their stomachs and hips, and 3 out of 4 said they hated their thighs. 3 out of 4. Now these are the same women who were not, for the most part, overweight. Okay? So we know two things about us as women. One, we're never thin enough. And two, even if we were thin enough, our thighs would still be too fat. So this ideal is always out of reach. For each one of us, it's always out of reach. If our culture told us that it was okay to have a wide range of acceptable body shapes and sizes, we wouldn't feel about our bodies the way we do today. But that's not what our culture tells us.
And it's not quite the same problem for men, is it? Think about what the perfect measurements are for a man. We all know what they are for a woman, right? But there isn't that same kind of a standard for a man.
No, there isn't. And there isn't as narrow an age ideal either. Gray-haired men can be handsome. Thinner men can be handsome. There's a big difference in the way men and women see their bodies. We talked about this a little bit in the last session, but I want to review for those of you who are new. For a woman, the ideal is a shape, a certain way of looking. For a man, it's much more tied, and it has been tied, to what his body can do. And that difference starts real early. Studies done with high school students show that in between 9th and 12th grade, what boys want to do is they want to gain weight in order to be able to do more with their body. So they like to weight train. Girls want to lose weight. And by adulthood, the difference can be summed up very easily. You can say, well, men talk sports and women talk diets. And what's interesting about that is that if you have a performance ideal, what your body can do, you can feel a lot better about your body. Because in this culture, for example, where jogging is in and marathon running for men is a real option, that kind of exercise favors a very tall, lean body. So men who years ago couldn't make the football team and had a harder time feeling good about their bodies can now feel very acceptable. Women still don't have that as much for an ideal. Even though, I mean, you might be thinking, well, what about the Olympics, you know, and now women can do more with their bodies. And that's very true. And women are getting more performance oriented. But still, when you model the running fashions, they don't pick women marathon.
They pick models.
Yeah, they
Christy
pick models.
Brinkley.
Yeah, unless you're real famous and it's in a running magazine. So it's important for us as women to understand that we are going to be more obsessed with our body shape because that is the ideal than our husbands or men are in general, and that we're going to be feeling worse about our bodies than they generally do.
Okay, so I don't look like Jane Fonda. Why can't I just say, big deal, and on with life, so I'm never going to have that waist that's up there. That's not what we do, though. Instead, our reaction might be one like this. We want to read you a little piece from a book here, This Woman's Experience. When I went past a mirror, I would put my hands over my eyes, frightened of what I might behold there. I even hit on the toaster and the curved surface of a large spoon or the fender of a polished car. And that's not too outlandish. How do you all feel when you go past a store window and you look at your reflection in a window? Okay. In that mood, the world seemed filled with reminders that I was not as slender as the woman on the magazine cover, that I, in spite of all my will and effort, was not able to make myself lean and gaunt. What's shocking here is that this author, Kim Chernin, at the time she wrote this, was 5'4 and consistently weighed under 120. So it didn't particularly matter. She still felt that she was fat. Now, you may not hide from toasters, but think about how you go to the swimming pool or the beach. You wear your cover up, right? And you select a spot not next to a person who looks like one of these. And
there aren't very many.
Okay, and you don't take your cover off until you don't take your jacket off. You lie down because your stomach's flatter when you lie down. Or if you're at a pool, it's terrible if there are none of the lounge chairs left and you have to sit up in a chair, because when you sit up, you roll, you know, hey. So you always got to get yourself into this position so that you look as thin as possible. I used to always keep I always wanted to get my belly tan, so I liked to wear a bikini when I was sunbathing, but I always kept a towel handy so that if anybody came into my backyard, I could real quickly, discreetly lay this towel across my waist, because that's the thickest part of my body, and that was you may put it across your thighs. It depends on how you feel about your various body parts. The question is, why are we so obsessed with the shape of our bodies? Why is this so important to us that we're perpetually worried and fretting about it and feeling awful about ourselves?
Well, actually, it's very logical. It's very logical that the way we feel about our bodies is very involved with the way we feel about ourselves, because we are body selves. We're not body out here. No, the body out here and the real me in here. I am a whole person. I am an embodied person. And because of that, feelings about my body, which is called technically my body image, relates to and affects the way I see and feel about myself, which is called my self-image. Very natural connection. But that is a problem for us as women, because from early on we have had the profound sense that we are falling short of some ideal. And so we have had negative experiences in our life, competing to be valued as a competent business executive or consultant or teacher or whatever. She still is not free of the tie between body shape and value. This is an important thing for you to understand. That is the difference between the way men and women feel about their bodies in terms of value. Men feel much more a sense of value and worth from their professions. The kind of self-disgust or tie to our bodies that we experience is probably most similar for them to the kind of anxiety and terror and fear they would feel if they lost their jobs or if they didn't get their promotion. You can't expect that your husband is going to feel exactly the same about his body as you do feel about yours. And I think that's an important difference.
Well, furthermore, a man's self-worth is enhanced, if not by the shape of his own body, by the shape of your body, if it's your husband or your father. So that puts an added pressure on us as women, that it's important to our husbands and important to the men in our lives that we look a certain way, because that says something about them. You know, if a man has a gorgeous wife, then he can feel better about it.
Well, the opposite works in a sense, too, because for us, we feel much better about ourselves if our husband is successful. If you think about it, even if we had a husband who was very obese, if he were a bank president, we could still feel good about ourselves, in a sense. So his our worth and value as far as our husband is concerned is much more tied to what he does professionally. And that's a big difference.
What happens is we go to any extreme because our self-worth is so much at stake here. We really are in a position where we have to go to extremes, or we feel we have to get a certain kind of a body in order to
love ourselves. So we do things like, we wrap our bodies to melt away the fat. One thing we'll do.
Or we send away for those belts. Did you ever send away for one of those inflatable belts that you put around your waist and you blow up and then you lie down and it's supposed to melt away? Nobody else did that? Or else? I have a few of those. Of course, most women are working on their thighs, and I happen to have mine up a little higher, and I have a few of those in my closet.
Yeah,
they come in a brown wrapper.
Yeah, I didn't have as much problem with my waist. I was one who did 1,000 leg lifts a day for my thighs.
Try to get rid of your thighs. Or we diet. We go on the quick weight loss diet, the inches off diet, the grapefruit diet, the Scarsdale diet, the Beverly Hills diet, the Hollywood diet, the I Love New York diet. The latest one I saw the other day was a lollipop diet. You suck on lollipops all day, and then I guess it keeps you from eating other things. Your teeth fall out. But who cares if you got teeth as long as you have a skinny body, right? When one diet fails, what do? You go find another one. Right,
listen to how dieting makes us feel about ourselves. Listen for this connection between dieting and self-worth. This is by a woman who wrote a wonderful book, Stop Dieting and Start Living. This is about her dieting journal. She said, "It was filled with self-recrimination. This time I will succeed. I won't be a failure again. It was filled with hopes for the future, plans for how different my life would be when I was thin, and worst of all, it was filled with moral values given to food and eating. I saw from that journal that I considered myself a failure, a bad person, not because of my actions or how I lived my life, but because of one simple fact, how much I ate. My worth was measured out in calories consumed."
A more extreme example that's taken from a book called The Obsession, which is an excellent book. It's called, the subtitle is The Tyranny of Slenderness. The author tells a story about a woman who had a very serious stomach ailment. They thought she had cancer, and she had to have some surgery and go into the hospital for a while, and all her friends were worried about her. As a result of this, turned out she was fine, but as a result of this, she lost 5 pounds. And her friends were actually envious of her because she had lost that weight, even though they witnessed what she had gone through. And when it was all over, she said to the author, she said, "I'd like to tell you that I wouldn't go through that again to lose the 5 pounds, but I'm not sure it's true. I think I might go through it again." Another interesting one, there was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle about stomach stapling, you know, the thing you can have to so that you lose weight. And the article told all kinds of terrible things that happened to this woman who had her stomach stapled, about infections she got and about she had to go back and have the surgery redone, and a whole lot of misery for many, many weeks. And I think she gained weight back eventually anyway. But when the day the article was released, the newspaper office was flooded with calls from women wanting to know where they could get the operation done. Also on the extreme, we mentioned in the first session, I don't know how many of you were here, but you may or may not be aware that there is a rampant epidemic in this culture today of the anorexia and bulimia. Anorexia, the eating disorder where young women, 1 out of 10 in our culture, 1 million young women are starving themselves, purposely not eating food to try to get thinner, and to the point where they lose a quarter of all of their body fat. And bulimia, another eating disorder which is even more prevalent, they think up to as much as 50% on some college campuses among the women of girls
at
who
least
are
30 to 50. So 1 out of 3.
It's a much harder disorder to detect because people remain a normal weight where you eat large amounts of food and then throw it up or take laxatives to get rid of it. These are very complicated eating disorders that have lots of factors behind them, but over and over the experts who work with people that have these eating disorders are pointing as to one very strong cause, underlying cause, is the continuing increasing obsession with thinness that's going on in this culture.
We have really balked the line. You can never be too thin. You can never be too thin. And the logical extreme of anorexia and what's actually happened is It's better dead than fat. Better dead than fat.
Now, enough of this. Yeah. let's hear something good. Let's hear some good news instead of this. We have a handout there that's gold we'd like you to take a look at, because we want to paint for you today as well as we can. And we wish we had hours instead of just a half an hour left. We want to give you some ideas about how you can gain some freedom from the misery. I don't know you all individually, and I don't know what the extent of your frustration is with this, but I know a lot of women, and I know a lot of women are miserable, and they're tired of dieting, and they feel defeated, and they get feeling worse and worse each time, and they don't like their bodies very well. So we want to see if we can help you a little bit with this.
The first one may not sound extremely positive, but it really is, because the first step is this one. There's freedom in recognizing that we're caught in the body shape trap. And the reason it's freeing is because you can't get out of a trap until you know you're in one. And in this culture, we have assumed and bought the line that real freedom is looking like that. And not until we get that shape, that thinness, will we really be free. Then our life will be terrific, but not till then. That's freedom. If we could actually see that that's a reverse, if we could see that that is a trap, it could totally change our perspective. For example, dieting is the perfect example. We know how to diet. Oh man, do we know how to diet. We know how it feels like to be on one.
Terrible.
Yeah. And we know how it feels to be off of the diet.
Guilty.
Right. But we don't know how not to diet. If we had to think of quitting dieting forever, we'd be scared. It's an unknown. We don't know. We only know what it's like to be on and off, not without. The patterns of feelings and behaviors that we have been experiencing are so automatic to us that they feel natural. But now we can begin to take a step back and see them as a trap. And one way that we can make this even stronger is to see how destructive being caught in this trap is, because then we'll be willing to fight to get out. And the first thing that's real obvious is that it's that constantly the way I feel about myself fluctuates. My self-love is temporary. Every single body experience I have is like a test. Even if I do really good 1 minute, the next minute I could fail. Listen to the writer of a popular fitness magazine, a Christian writer. Okay, here's what she said. When I step on the scale in the morning and my weight has stayed the same or gone down, I am happy and optimistic all day long. But let that scale show me a half a pound or a pound gain and I am upset for hours, especially if I think I didn't cheat and I don't deserve the gain. I know now that I may not lose a pound every day, and that fluctuations in the amount of water in my system could show an extra pound gain some mornings, even when I didn't go off my diet. But even knowing this, I still feel impatient and angry when the scales don't go my way, and I often make myself miserable the rest of the day. Okay? The way she solves this problem is, she says, well, I must have been cheating. Even though I know in my head, my weight can fluctuate, still when the scale shows it, I think I must be cheating. And she ends the section by praying to God to help her be more honest about cheating and to help her be more consistent. In addition, the way we feel is dependent on the way other people respond to us. For example, when you walk into a room and you meet a friend of yours, don't you always feel like you should say, you look great. You look thinner. Have you lost weight? You know, it's kind of the way we women have learned to relate to each other, to say, you're okay, I'm okay. And you know what? We say it even if both of us obviously know there's been no weight gained or lost. So if our friend says it to us and we haven't lost weight, we know they're just saying it to make us feel good. But still, if they didn't say it, we'd wonder if we looked like we've really gained a lot of weight.
We're even dependent upon imagined responses. We imagine people are thinking certain things about us, even if they don't say anything. When you go How do you feel when you feel like going back to get seconds at a church potluck? Don't you feel like everybody's looking at you and checking out your body and thinking that person should or shouldn't? If your men don't have that problem, they can go back at number. In fact, we expect them to go back. Another thing that happens is we get to competing with our friends, sometimes with our very best friends or with people we love the most. For instance, when you go on a diet with a friend, you compete. You want to lose more weight than she does. You want to look thinner than your friend lying on the beach. When you are going out to a luncheon with a group of women, you call each other and say, "What are you wearing?" Sometimes what the underlying purpose is that you really want to look better than the other people that you're with. It's often subtle. Sometimes it's not quite so subtle. Even if we know we can't get to look like Jane Fonda or Christie Brinkley or one of these women, we still want to look at least as good as, and hopefully a little better than, the people that we associate with on a daily basis.
You know what? I want to be free of this. I want to be free of feeling bad about myself every time I see a 10 body in a magazine. I want to be free to buy a bathing suit and not feel terrible about myself every time I look in those three-way mirrors.
Those are terrible.
They're only in women's dressing rooms.
And you know, I want to be free to believe the people who do love me, who tell me I look okay. A quick personal aside here, I have, in the last, maybe 5 or 6 years, I have weighed 150, and I have weighed 105, and now I'm somewhere in between, which isn't the cultural ideal quite. I don't think I'm as skinny as Jane Fonda. I think she weighs 109 or something like that. When I weighed 105, I thought I looked wonderful. It was very temporary, by the way. But some people real close to me told me I looked terrible. And I did not believe them. I thought, if they were women, I thought they were jealous. Some of them were men, like my brother and my brothers and my husband. Now that I weigh 130, which is a weight that I have been schooled to believe is not the greatest weight, I have a hard time sometimes believing that I'm okay. When my husband says to me, "You're fine," I'm getting better, but it's a little hard for me to believe that. What happens is, when our husbands tell us we look fine, as some of them don't, unfortunately, but some of them do, is we actually sort of, it demeans them. We think, well, what does he know? Or if he can love this body, then he must not be all that valuable. I mean, it's a subtle thing we do. We see it with college students all the time. A girl who doesn't feel good about herself, if a guy likes her, she immediately thinks he's not good enough. How could he be if he's interested in her, when she feels so rotten about herself?
I'd like some freedom from continual thinking about my body, from being so obsessed. When my life could be so full, and when my life is so full, I'd like to be freer. I can think of a number of things during the day that I'd be much happier doing and better at doing if I weren't disappointed and disgusted with myself from the time I stepped on the scales.
Let's look at the second thing on the list. There's also freedom in understanding why you are where you are, why we are as women where we are. We want to help you see that this begins very early, and it's something that you really don't have a lot of control over, getting to where you are. Take Melissa, for example, a little three-year-old girl who comes out with her hair all in ribbons and her pretty Christmas dress, and her daddy says, "Oh, you look so pretty. I'm so proud of you."
And then when she's four, she sees her mom constantly dieting, and her mom says to her, "I hope you don't have thighs that look like mine when you grow up."
Or when she's seven, she sees her father watching football and hears him making comments about the cheerleaders, and she sees her mother's reaction, which is not very pleased.
And at 10, she sees her mom dieting constantly, and she sees her groaning when she gets off the scale, and she hears her mom's friends talking about how they need to lose weight.
Or when she's in junior high school, she goes to the Dairy Queen with a cousin, a male cousin, and he orders a banana split, and she orders a banana split, and he says to her, "Oh, don't be a pig. You have an ice cream cone." You know, girls aren't supposed to eat banana splits.
And at 16, she's very bright but average looking, and she's the editor of the school newspaper, but she doesn't get as many dates as her friend who's the blonde cheerleader.
or when she goes away to college or freshman year and comes home at Thanksgiving vacation 10 or 15 or 20 pounds heavier, and her father says, you're getting a little chunky there, aren't you?
And when she's a newlywed, she's in the grocery store with her husband, and he points to a woman who's obese, and he's laughing, and he says, if you ever get like that, I'll divorce you.
Do we need to go on? You probably can't remember your experiences at age 3, but this has been happening all along, and I think it's happening even more strongly in today's culture than it was when some of you were 3 years old. In fact, the research that we've been reading says that this is the first generation of young women today, the teenagers and the college-age girls, this is the first generation whose mothers were body-obsessed. So we're into this particular cycle.
You know what? When you're 3 years old or 4 years old or 6 or 7 or 10, you can't step back and say, you know, something bad is happening to me here. I'm being told my body's not so good. And I'm being told my value as a person is connected to the way my body shapes. This is wrong. I think I'll ignore this. I'll ignore this and develop instead a real positive view about my body and who I am as a person. Can't do that. Even as an adult, unless you've had unique experiences where people really valued you for who you are, it's real hard to step back.
What we're trying to say is don't blame yourself if you are into this or partially or totally into this mindset, because you didn't dream up this culture that has this body-obsessed, super thin, you know, ideal kind of a body.
Of course not. If we lived in Africa where stretched lips around plates, we're gorgeous, we'd all be trying as hard as we can to stretch our lips.
Yeah, the exercise teacher would be saying, come on, girls, stretch those lips. Get in the bigger plate.
Even if we lived in China years ago when they bound feet, we'd be all saying, yeah, bind them, man, bind them, even though we'd be crippled as a result.
You're not responsible for being in the trap. But what we want to help you see is that you are responsible for getting out of it once you understand that you're in it and once you understand how destructive it is. And we think you can do that.
And then there's real freedom in step number 3. That's letting go of the cultural ideal. There has to come a point in our lives where we say, this isn't true, this isn't right, and I'm going to let go of it. Listen to how this happened for the author of Stop Dieting, Start Living, the one I wrote, read a minute ago about her dieting journal. She said, the final decision to stop dieting came when I read a journal, the same journal I referred to. I began to understand what I meant by the wounds the years of dieting had created. There in black and white, page after page, was guilt and self-destruction. I couldn't believe I had done that to myself, that I could hurt myself so much, ask so much of myself, and be so unforgiving. As I read, tears spilled down on the pages, tears for lost happiness, for years of torment, for never forgiving myself for being fat, tears for myself as a young girl, miserable about my body, and for myself as a grown woman, filling those pages with despair, and finally, tears of relief, because in some way I knew it was over. I would never again subject myself to that kind of pain and guilt. I knew it wouldn't be easy, and it hasn't been. But as I saw my tears fall on those pages, I vowed they would be the last tears I ever shed because of my weight. Now listen real carefully. We are not saying that you can't lose weight. In the case of this woman, after she quit dieting, for the first time in her life, she lost weight and began consistently to keep it off. And we're not saying you can't change your body shape. With good exercise practices, you can change your body shape.
But we are saying there's a limit to what kind of changes you can make. That not everybody can look like Jane Fonda, which really isn't too radical an idea, I don't think, although it's real hard for us to let go of. Nancy and I, for instance, are similar in height and we're similar in weight, but we have really, really different body sizes.
Yeah,
Nancy has football calves.
Yep.
At least that's what your husband says.
He likes my football calves.
She keeps insisting that that's true. Yes, he truly does. I wish we had time to explain in much more detail to you why it's hard to get this ideal and some facts that tell us that there are some things we can't get. Well, one, for instance, is, you know, we all think that the 22-inch waist or the 23-inch waist is the ideal. If you know that my 4-year-old has a 21-inch waist, she's a very normal 4-year-old, and my 9-year-old niece has a 22-inch waist, maybe you'll understand. And babies, I think newborn babies have an average of 16 and 17-inch waist.
A 2 or 3-month-old baby has a waist of 16 or 17 inches.
Maybe that can help us understand what a woman, a grown woman, has to go through to keep a 23-inch waist. Now, some people are naturally born with it, obviously, but an awful lot of us are not. So it's a life of starvation to keep a waist that small for a good number of people who do keep it.
It's important to understand that in the past 50 years, when the health of women has been increasing and when actually, biologically, we're bigger boned and we're taller at the very time when that's happened, and therefore our weight should naturally, the weight allowance should naturally be going up, the ideal is getting thinner and thinner.
Let's look at number 4. And I'm trying to find my handout here. There's freedom in, well, it's a long sentence. But basically what it's saying is there's freedom in changing what you do. And possibly this, practically speaking, is the best way you can begin to experience some freedom from the shape trap. The two major things we do to fix our shapes are things that actually work against us in real progress on our shapes. The two major things we do, we want to talk to you a little bit and show you how those work against us and how we can change them the way we do them to work for us. The first one is dieting. Let me explain. And the second one is spot reducing exercises. Those are the two major things we do. Dieting, again, I wish we had time, but dieting, especially low calorie dieting, you know, where you reduce to below like 1200 calories, go down to 1200 or 1000 calories a day, actually makes you fatter. Some of you may be reading about this these days in magazines. Briefly, it's more complicated than this, but briefly, here's what happens. When you go on a low calorie diet for more than a week, some of us can't stay on that even that long, but for more than a week, your body, because God designed it for survival, and because for hundreds of thousands of years human bodies have had to survive without food, your body actually readjusts to get along on less food. What happens, in essence, is it's a metabolism fall. Your metabolism shuts down. It's like an economy car. You go further on a smaller amount of fuel. And so what happens is after a couple weeks or even as short as a week, you can get along with fewer calories. 1,000 calories is enough to subsist on for you. So you do lose some weight initially, but then it falls off. When you go off your diet, your body does not go back to normal, sometimes for months, which means your body needs 1,000 calories, but you've gone back to a normal eating level. Which means you are going to, that's, that it helps to explain to us all why we gain weight back. Not all of it, not all at once, but very gradually. Furthermore, that happens faster every time you diet. The more often you diet, the faster your metabolism clicks into low gear and the longer it takes to get back out of it. In addition to that, when you lose on a low calorie diet, unless you are doing vigorous aerobic exercise, at the same time, which is impossible to do on 1,000 calories because you don't have the energy, you will burn mostly muscle, and you will lose mostly muscle and water. You lose very little fat. However, when you gain the weight back, which most of us inevitably do, what you gain back is fat. So if you lose 20 pounds, you'll lose 15 pounds of muscle and water and only 5 pounds of fat. But when you gain it back, you'll gain back 15 pounds of fat. You end up 10 pounds fatter than you were before, even if your weight doesn't show it. So dieting really works against us the way we have gone about pursuing it. And
we can't cover that adequately, but if on the back of this golden sheet.
No, it's on the blue sheet.
Sorry. On the back
we've
of
recommended
the blue
to you,
sheet.
We've recommended to you the very best books that we know that explain this whole thing. I would highly recommend that every woman who's interested in good permanent weight loss ought to buy Dr. Martin Kaytan's book, Beyond Diet.
Or get it at your public library.
Yeah, take it out of the library and Xerox the pages. Is that against the law? No, if you Xerox one page with some information for yourself, isn't that legal? I'm sorry. Being in the publishing business, I take that back. I should never say that. Buy the book. But just one other interesting fact, and again, this is a long story, but there's a great deal of fascinating research now that shows that it's very likely that it is dieting that makes people compulsive eaters. What that means is that possibly if you had never dieted, you wouldn't have those binges where you have to eat a whole pan of brownies. That it's actually that depriving of our bodies that makes normal eaters become people who can't stop. So that's another.
Well, what about exercise? Well, the way we've gone about exercise is spot reducing. You know, we go to those classes where you circle your arms and then you do 100 sit-ups and then you do 1,000 leg raises in every different position on your right side, on your left side with your knee bent, with your knees straight.
With your foot flexed, with your foot pointed.
Right, right. The misconception about that is that those kinds of exercises, we do those because we want to get our thighs thinner or our waist smaller, but your body doesn't work that way. When you do those kinds of exercises, they strengthen muscles in that area, and that's why when you do sit-ups, because the muscle's stronger, you look thinner, in a sense, because it holds in the body more. But those muscles don't, doing those kind of exercises, don't burn fat in those areas. Fat is burned from over your whole body, the whole layer of fat between your skin and your muscles. Your body has no way of knowing you want to lose it off your thighs first. Chances are you'll lose it in your bust first, you know? And so to spend great amounts of time doing that kind of exercise, we feel, is damaging in a couple ways. For one thing, it takes a lot of time and it prevents you many times from doing aerobic exercise, which is the real kind of exercise that burns and metabolizes fat. And secondly, it keeps you in this whole ideal idea. You know, it keeps you thinking about getting in shape, you know, thighs, waist, etc. We don't have a lot of time to talk about aerobic exercise, but let me at least say this. Aerobic exercise is the kind that uses your whole body, so it's not leg lifts.
No matter how fast you do leg lifts, they are not aerobic.
No, they're not aerobic, even if you do them to fast music. Okay? Aerobic exercise is exercise like walking, jogging, swimming, biking, cross-country skiing.
Did you say swimming? Jump roping?
Jump roping, that kind of thing. And that is the kind of exercise that burns fat.
There's some information about aerobic exercise on this tan sheet that's in your little packet here, and that gives where we've tried to give you a general fitness plan that we don't have time to go into detail on, but that will describe it to you.
We like not only what aerobic exercise does, because it conditions your entire cardiovascular system and is the best way, the way, to control weight in addition to normal eating, but also because it goes very nicely with the idea of accepting yourself as you are and being in the process of changing. And it's not at all related to the shape ideal.
Just one additional note on the aerobic exercise business. The people that we know who have really kept weight off for a long period of time and are dealing with weight and maintaining normal weight best are people who are doing some sort of aerobic exercise. It does not have to be jogging. Now, a lot of people at various ages don't like to jog. Walking is an excellent aerobic exercise and one we heartily recommend to people because it's safe for people of all ages and all body types, even people who have a great deal of weight to lose. Let's look at the last one on this sheet. There's freedom. There's real freedom here in the real answer to the whole self-worth quest. And that is God's unconditional love and forgiveness and acceptance. And that's an idea we want to be really clear about. The culturally approved body shape that we all wish we had was not God's idea. It's not God's ideal. It's one of many ideals that he designed, but only 5% of the people were born to have it. God designed a variety of bodies, and you can just tell by going to a beach that that's the case. And your basic body design is an ideal in his sight every bit as much as Jane Fonda's. We keep hearing, even in our Christian exercise books and fitness books and records, we keep hearing that God wants you to be thin. Or if you're beautiful, then you'll be a better witness for Christ. or if you're overweight, you're not a good Christian, or you're not a good witness.
And that you'd pray that what God's interested in doing is helping you get more discipline and willpower to be beautiful.
And we real quickly take that idea on. We kind of think that the Miss Americas and the winners, you know, the rich, the successful, whatever, are the people that can best communicate God's word to the world. Well, that's not really the truth, we don't think. We think that that's not what God is telling us.
No, God has a very high view of persons and bodies. On the back of this gold sheet,
yes,
we don't have time to talk to you about this now, but the idea that we've heard from our Christian experiences, which is that your body's the temple of God, the idea that you're supposed to present your body a living sacrifice to God, and we view those in terms of your physical body. That's what's often used in Christian fitness books. This is why you should get your body into shape. That's poor exegesis or understanding of what those words mean. And what this sheet will help you do is rethink those words. Because what body actually means, the context of those verses in the original language in Greek, does not specify physical body only. It means whole person. The right translation of those verses would be, present your whole person a living sacrifice, and your whole person is a temple of God. What's also real interesting is to think of the flesh idea. We've always thought of giving into the lust of the flesh as overeating or doing simple things, drinking, smoking, that kind of thing. The living according to the lust of the flesh biblically means trying to get righteous by your own means, refusing to live in grace, refusing to be forgiven. And so Paul uses it often when he talks about circumcision of the law. And then discipline is a real interesting one to think too. But anyway, we don't have time to go into that.
We knew we wouldn't, so we printed that out for you so that you could think about it. The sound of freedom in all this is that God loves you, God loves me, whole, in the body. God wants us to be free. We don't think God stands around cheering our obsession with our bodies at all. We think God weeps. We think when our best friend, one of our best friends back in Oregon, spends the day bemoaning her body and feeling just absolutely terrible about the shape of her body, we think God looks at her and weeps for the lost potential and for the wasted energy there. When we beg for forgiveness for not being able to stick to our fad diet longer than one day, I think God weeps that that's what we're after. He doesn't say, you're a slob, shape up. No. He feels sad that we're so consumed with it. We don't need to be forgiven because we can't lose 5 or 10 or 100 pounds. I think we need to be forgiven for thinking that our worth or anyone else's worth depends on whether we lose 5 or 10 or 100 pounds. When we step on the scale and we've gained a half pound, we don't need to pray for more discipline to stick to our diets. I think what we need to pray for is courage to weigh less often and maybe even the courage to throw our scales right out the window. And therefore we may be free to really lose the weight.
What we really need as Christians is the wisdom not to do to our daughters what has been done to us. And what we really need as Christians is the courage to tell each other that the cultural ideal is a lie and that we are grace body selves, loved as persons.
We realize that this may not be what you expected to hear when you came in here, that you might have been hoping we were going to give you a plan with God's help that you could get to look like Jane Fonda. And so, because our time is so short and we don't have time to deal with the whole struggle of it, we just want to be honest and say we know it's not something you can get out of tomorrow. We struggle with this cultural thing and we'll continue to struggle with it.
You know what? We really need to be begging God to encounter us with his love and his unconditional acceptance so that we can experience, in the sense of knowing, experience-wise, that we are loved. As it is now, we can sing Jesus Loves Me as naturally as we breathe, and we quit that song, and we step on the scales, and we're depressed. And it's because we're not experiencing the love and the worth that is ours in God, who valued us as much as he valued himself, showing us in a dramatic way, far beyond anything we could imagine, that is his death and his resurrection. There isn't any greater statement of worth and value.
On the one hand, I believe this because I've been thinking about it, we've been talking about it and experiencing it for a couple of years. On the other hand, it's real hard to let go of that idea that I could look like one of these people. It's more glamorous in a way, that particular ideal. And so I'm caught in a situation of belief and unbelief. I want to believe that God's love, you know, is really there and that it can free me, and on the other hand, it's real hard to believe.
Our prayer needs to be, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief.